Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There was a time, not that long ago, when the digital revolution was seen as a kind of techno-utopia. And many people still do see it this way, as an open and free place where everyone has an equal voice and equal opportunities to be heard, where traditional media gatekeepers and commercial interests are vanquished in favor of an all-out digital democracy. And again, many people do still see the online world in exactly this way. But a growing number of activists and thinkers feel quite differently. They say the new digital democracy is more like digital feudalism, where masses of people create free content of inconsistent quality, but all of it produces a profit for giant internet corporations, and that these corporations are actually more concentrated and less socially responsible than their old media counterparts. It is a very searing indictment, but one that's eloquently made by author, filmmaker, and activist Astra Taylor in her new book entitled The People's Platform: Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. She joins us now from New York. Astra, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you go deep into all the reasons why you think that we're not necessarily experiencing the promise of digital democracy as we may have thought of 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago. But I'm wondering if you could just give us a few examples. Like, what do you think is one of the most telling ways in which the online world isn't as free and open as we might think?
Well, there are plenty of examples. The web has not been the sort of Robin Hood stealing from the audience rich and giving it to the audience poorer that we thought it would inevitably evolve into. So, you know, one is that the old media dinosaurs have not gone extinct. They haven't been vanquished by the new digital upstarts the way that we imagined. So the profits year after year and the stock valuations for legacy media companies like Disney or CBS or whatever it might be, those are actually going up. Their share prices are rising. So they're still in the Fortune 500 firmament. But alongside them, and increasingly collaborating with them, are these new digital titans, so the Googles and Facebooks and Apples of the world, that are now some of the biggest companies on Earth. So Google and Apple, it was just announced that they have their market capitalization makes them the two biggest companies in the world. Mm-hmm.
But let me just jump in for a second. Massive market cap for a small number of companies doesn't necessarily have to equate to a squelching of voices, because one of the things about the digital world that still remains true is that, you know, we hear all the time about the low barriers to entry. I mean, you don't need to pay anything to get a Twitter account, and you too can be heard.
Yeah, and that's what we're told. But, you know, of course it doesn't feel that way when you're tweeting out into the void because you've only got a few followers and, you know, someone else has a million followers or 2 million followers, or a company on Facebook, which is able to promote its posts and promote its status by having deep pockets, you know, has millions of friends and likes. So there's the followed and the followers, and there are still these asymmetries. And there's something called the bandwagon effect, where there's kind of rich get richer phenomenon, where things that are popular get more popular online. And there's something about the frictionless networked world that exacerbates that and makes it even more of a problem than it was before the internet was dominant. And they're the same thing. The same old problems from the old age of money and buying access. I mean, it is true that in bookstores like Barnes & Noble, it's often what you see on the front tables is someone paid to put it there. Yeah. It's the same thing with the front page of Amazon. The difference is now that instead of going to a diverse, you know, array of bookstores, whether it's Barnes & Noble or maybe our local independent shop, we're all going to Amazon.com, or an overwhelming number of us are, and there's one front page. And so, you know, who gets on the front placement is very powerful. because it's a global company.
Yeah, so let's dig into this a little bit more about, like, who gets front placement, who gets heard, who are the big headliners? Because, I mean, you spend quite a bit of time in the book really sort of dissecting the myth, and I come back to this repeatedly because I think a lot of us just do presume that there is more or less an equality of access, so therefore an equality of voice. But you, yeah, you know, you take a look at, like, for example, who are the most popular bloggers, and you find that they're overwhelmingly of one, perhaps not unsurprising, group.
Right. I mean, a media democracy has to reflect. If a media democracy worth its name would reflect the diverse characteristics of, you know, the American population, and it was easy to see in the old media system, you'd look at the op-ed pages and you'd go, wow, here are some people who are mostly white, mostly male. They went to elite universities. But scholars who have broken this down, there's a fellow named Matthew Hinman who is at the vanguard of this kind of work. He did an analysis of the top bloggers a few years back and found that they were more elite, more white, more male, more well-educated and well-off than the op-ed pages of yore. So there's something about the supposedly open nature of the digital world that can actually disguise inequality because, it's not clear what who is keeping them out. If there aren't the old gatekeepers, then what is it that's creating these inequities or perpetuating them?
I mean, do you have any theories about that?
Yeah, I mean, it has to do with, again, this issue of network effects and we go and bandwagon effects, that we go to the familiar, we go to what's already known. And when there's less of a structure there to bring other people up, it's harder for them. You know, that's why we have institutions with affirmative action, perhaps, or equal opportunity hiring, and because what it does is it creates inroads for people who would otherwise be marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think we have to first recognize that despite what could hypothetically happen with technology, hypothetically everyone can speak and hypothetically everyone can be heard, we have to look at what's really happening in the way that, you know, the internet doesn't magically erase social inequalities. It doesn't magically give all women equal opportunity or free time to participate. I mean, there's still the problem, for example, that, you know, women are home working a second shift. They have less time to spend on the internet. Therefore, they participate less in these forums. And, you know, material problems carry over to the digital sphere.
Yeah. Well, listeners, I'm speaking with Astra Taylor. She's a filmmaker and activist and author of the new book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. And I'm wondering, listeners, what you think about what Astra Taylor is saying, that perhaps the promise of the digital democracy that we all think we might be living in isn't necessarily panning out. I mean, do you still feel the promise of the digital revolution? Does it have the power to democratize expression? Or do you agree with what Astra Taylor says and perhaps see that giants like Facebook and Google are monetizing your every click and fashioning platforms that have economics and not necessarily freedom of expression in mind? And I'm also curious, because I know there's a lot of listeners who work in this field, the internet still holds so much promise. Do you believe that the digital revolution contains the solutions within itself for some of the problems we've been discussing? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or you can actually also use digital means. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Astra, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about sort of the, I guess, the conundrum that the culture of the digital world we live in or has when it comes to how problems are treated on the internet, because you make a really interesting point about, say, how women are treated in terms of on online forums and comment spaces that sort of tell us a lot about the particular brand of libertarianism that we find emerging from Silicon Valley.
Right. I mean, part of the idea of openness is that any attempt to lift people up or any sort of institutions or structures are kind of anathema, right? That, you know, that. But the problem with this vision is that it means that a few outspoken misogynists or trolls or whatever you want to call them can actually suppress other people's voices. And so it's a problem that's getting a lot more attention in the media as women musicians and filmmakers and just, you know, regular people who live online like we all do are speaking out about the disproportionate harassment that women and other minorities get. And it's not just anecdotal. There was a study, and I cited in the book, that said that to use a female screen name online attracts 25 times the harassing and negative messages than using a male screen name. So there's advice from these scholars who did this, and they said, okay, if you have a daughter, maybe ask her to use a different name, which means essentially don't be yourself on the internet. And that is such a step backwards. I mean, the idea of the internet was that we would transcend our bodies and we could be who we really were or be ourselves. And here we are saying, no, you have to hide that. You know, you have to use a man's name if you want to be respected.
Well, we've got a call here, so let's go to it. Steve is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Steve.
Meghna, I am wondering why, for example, if women are not equally represented in certain fields, your guest presupposes that that's because they're being kept out. Now, it may very well be, and I know this is something that got Larry Summers fired from Harvard, but it may very well be that they are not as eager to participate in that field or as ambitious in that particular regard. And I'm thinking of, for example, the WhatsApp fellow who developed WhatsApp and now is a multi-billion-dollar rich man. I mean, I don't think there was anything keeping women out. It's just that for some reason, and I won't say what it is because I don't know, men seem more eager to go there than women.
Oh, interesting. So, Steve, just FYI, you're speaking to someone who's got 3 degrees in science, so not all women are afraid of going into the field. But I take your point. Astrid Taylor, Steve is opening up a can of worms there, but I'm just wondering what your response is to him.
Oh, it is a can of worms. It's one I just completely disagree with, and it's a response you often get from men when they're faced with some of the statistics. I mean, I think let's look at computer science degrees. In 1980, 37% of computer science degrees went to women, and now that number is shrinking over time. It's down to something like 17 or 18%. So why were more women interested in 1980? What's happened in those passing years? Well, you know, one thing is that more money and status has flowed to that field, to those disciplines. And what happens, and this is well proven, this is that, you know, people who have the money, the venture capitalists who are investing in startups and in technology tend to invest in people who are like them. So if it's a guy who's holding the wallet strings, I won't say purse strings, he tends to invest in other young men. And there are many ways that women are kept out. There's issues of, again, the fact that they have more responsibilities in the home. There's the fact that there's a sort of lack of mentorship. I mean, there are a lot of theories. And there are problems once they even if they get those degrees and they get the job, there's a challenge retaining them. Women's attrition rate in technology is 56%. It's quite a bit higher. It's remarkably higher than their male counterparts. A lot of women report that that's due to sexism or the fact that they're not taken as seriously at the table. And they're in this double bind where they're spoken over by men, but then if they assert themselves, they're seen as being too pushy. And so many women have made these observations that, you know, it's a little bit hubristic to just discount them and say, oh, I don't think that you all really are interested in this. When there are so many women saying, we are interested in this, but there are all of these obstacles and all of these ways that we're discriminated against.
Right.
We might want to take them seriously.
It's a point well made, and I don't necessarily mean to just drop it, but I do want to shift gears a little bit because, I mean, we've been spending a lot of time about how this new digital age that we're in, even though it has the promise of welcoming voices in, we're seeing the emergence of the opposite effect of perhaps making it harder for certain people to be heard, harder for certain people to enter fields, et cetera. But, I mean, I do wonder, I think a lot of people could point to many examples in which the digital revolution has truly had a democratizing or something of a democratizing effect. I mean, there might be those who look to the Arab Spring and say, look, it wasn't necessarily digital connectedness that catalyzed that revolution, but it, you know, it helped, you know, get the word out, get people's voices heard, especially from part of the world where maybe, you know, those of us here in America aren't used to, you know, hearing them in their own voices in real time. And then similarly, what about the Occupy Wall Street movement? I mean, you were very active in that, and I think that's just a perfect example of how the digital world really helped, in this case, truly catalyze the effect, because then all of a sudden we had Occupy everything from, you know, Boston to San Francisco to Burlington.
Yeah, I mean, this book in no way denies the power of these technologies and the democratizing possibilities. In fact, I'm saying that if we want to nurture that potential and we want to protect what we've gained, then we have to guard against the way that these growing business interests are going to start shifting the technology twisting the playing field. We're seeing this with net neutrality today. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some cause for alarm. There's an announcement from Tom Wheeler, who's the head of the FCC, that basically looks like we're heading towards a situation where there will be a fast lane, and that ISPs, internet service providers, will let those companies that can pay more for faster service pay more, and independent creators and regular people will be stuck in the slow lane. So we have to protect what we've gained, and so I'm not discounting its positive effects. I think the Arab Spring, though, is a really interesting example and one I've been thinking about, because it's easy to project onto a country far away that's very different politically than ours. I mean, an authoritarian dictatorship is not the kind of liberal democracy that we live in. And a new technology like the internet might have a very different consequence there. Right. Where your speech has been so suppressed for so long, and then to suddenly have these tools. And nonetheless, experts have pointed out that social media did get way too much credit, and there were things like trade unions and citizens groups that played very crucial roles. And that, in fact, when the internet was famously turned off in Egypt, that's when people actually went out into the streets, because suddenly they had to go out there. There was a brilliant essay about that in the New York Times. I recommend people read, because it's just so contrary to the sort of common myth of the Arab Spring. Occupy, you know, actually, I think, suffused my analysis, because I'm in a way talking about the 99% and the 1%. And while we can be grateful for the ways that we can collaborate and communicate online, we can also at the same time be aware and be critical about the way profits are flowing to an elite that is based in Silicon Valley, is extremely rich at a time of growing inequality across the economy. And these companies are setting themselves up to be woven into our lives like nothing else. So
in a way that we've never seen before. Astra, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I do want to get one more caller in here who wants to join us. Alan.
Let's democratize the conversation.
Exactly. Alan is calling from Boston's Leather District. You're on the air, Alan.
Hi there. I'm Alan. I'm actually the director of Startup Institute Boston. And I was calling actually just to comment on what one of your earlier callers had said about women not being as excited to join the technology field. Startup Institute is a career accelerator, and we actually had a graduation of our class today. And more than 50% of this class was female. And what our job is to really help get more talent into the startup community. And what we're finding is that there's equal interest from males and females. And what the challenge is not the level of interest, but how do you actually access the network and break into the field, and how do you know who to talk to? That's the bigger challenge that we're finding, not that there is an interest. I think that there's overwhelming interest from everybody, from every walk of life. And that's been the bigger challenge, is like, how do you break into the networks of the right people so that you can get to a job that you really love?
Alan, thank you so much for your call, because that actually, Astra, turns us to the last couple minutes of the time that we have left together. And I wanted to get straight to basically what's the subtitle of your book, which is Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. I mean, Alan's, you know, doing that in part by working at the Startup Institute of Boston, helping get people out there, helping to network them, regardless of gender. And I'm wondering, after doing this exhaustive study about the realities of our current digital landscape, I mean, do you have a prescription to keep this, the promise of the digital age as much as possible?
Yeah, I think that there are so many things that we as citizens can do. I mean, I think the first step is just to recognize that the technology can't do it on its own, and that, you know, we've had previous waves of sort of technological utopianism, and you know, there was a lot of excitement that the machines would eventually do all our work for us. And in fact, there was in the 60s people worrying about a crisis of leisure because the machines would put us all out of work and we'd all be rich and sitting around without anything to do. But the problem was that the machines, of course, are embedded in society, and the rewards didn't flow to everyone equally. So I think what that shows us is that you need to have a sort of political and social consciousness. And there are things we can do right now to push back. I would join groups like Free Press and Demand Progress as they advocate for net neutrality. I would think exactly like Alan is doing about solutions that bridge the offline and online, you know, the problems of discrimination and of access can't just be fixed by tech alone. We need to build institutions and structures that are that help people get a leg up and help people feel invited into these worlds.
Right.
And I think that we need to reassess the digital economy's dependence on advertising. I mean, that's a big part of the book, is looking at the way that all these free services we use are actually financed by what is essentially a surveillance business model. And, you know, people are very concerned about that now after the NSA revelations.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find other ways of financing our social media platforms, our cultural goods, or at least create some sort of baseline privacy laws that we can feel confident right. about as new technologies emerge.
Well, there are absolutely dozens of books to be written within just that last portion
true.
Of your ideas there. But Astra Taylor, author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, it was really great to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us
today.
Hey,
thanks for the good questions. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, listeners, you can keep this conversation going online. Do it, actually, yes, online, digitally. Send us a tweet about what you thought you heard today at Radio Boston. And stick with us, because coming up, we'll talk about last night's pine tar controversy at Fenway. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.